There has been some fairly recent academic studies that debunk whether that really works or not. In other words, what? Well, that's what this is based on. This is Jungian, but I'm talking about the guy from Harvard. He'll come to me in a minute. But we can talk about this at a later time. But you might just make a reference if you're interested. Look it up. But what the format test does is it categorizes people basically as action-oriented or observation-oriented, and as people-oriented or ideas-oriented. And so you end up with the nurse personality, car salesman personality, professor personality, and kind of a take-charge personality. And then you think in terms of matching your class, each of those types of people. Does that make sense? But let's go back to this test. What I thought it might be fun to do is first just kind of look at what everybody is and think about how it plays in the interaction. What's strange about it is that we have a preponderance of NTs in the room, right? And really we only have, what, three personality types in the entire room? And if you read the descriptions of personality types, the percentage of the population that's that personality type, right? So an NT, an INTJ, or a ENTJ, cumulatively is maybe 3% of the population, and we have over half the room fits in one of those two categories. Does that make sense? Now, but let's go through this. So does everybody understand the difference between an extroverted personality and introverted personality? So in general terms, an introverted personality, in order to recharge, would rather go to the beach and read. An extroverted personality, to recharge, would go to a party, right? Can an introvert be a good head instructor at a school? Sure. The thing is, though, it wears them out, right? So if you have an introvert who's a head instructor, they get off for the day, they're not going to go now to a nightclub to interact with people for 3 hours, right? An extrovert, the energy of the class recharges them, if you will. An introvert, the energy of the class wears them out. So typically, a generalization is an introvert can be a good head instructor in spurts, not necessarily, you know, the 40-hour week is going to drain them. Does that make sense? So you see, a lot of you guys who end up in that introvert personality, if you put yourself on the floor 40 hours a week, it drains you. But if you're on the floor for 5 hours a week, you do great. Intuition versus sensation is a little different. It's about how you make decisions. And sensation, think of that as data. And intuition, think about it as pulling together disparate pieces of data, but making intuitive leaps. Does that make sense? So if you look at somebody who's an S, they tend to deal with what's concrete and what's there in front of them. Whereas somebody who's an intuitive will make a leap that doesn't necessarily fit the data. Does that make sense? So if you look at obviously Steve Jobs has been in the news a lot recently with his passing. Clearly he was an intuitive, because most things that he came out with didn't fit the data points that was what the next thing should be, right? So he made a lot of intuitive leaps into a new product that, you know, maybe other people had tread that line before, but put it together in such a way that you wouldn't have thought was the next iteration step. You look at a company like Samsung right now, or HP. Well, what those companies are doing is they're taking the next incremental improvement. Doesn't mean it's not a process that works through, but they're, instead of making a leap into something that's completely different, they're doing iterative steps into the next new thing. Does that make sense? So thinking versus feeling is again pretty straightforward, but making decisions through logic versus making decisions through emotion. Okay, so a feeling type will naturally be more empathetic towards other people. A thinking type will naturally come across a little bit more distant, but a thinking type will have a tendency to make decisions and move forward based upon putting all the decision points together or all the data points together, more so than how they feel about it, what their emotional reaction is. And the interesting one here, was anybody a Pete? Did anybody come out as being a Pete? That's interesting. Judger is somebody who likes every interaction to have closure. A perceiver is one that lets it be open-ended. Okay? And from a standpoint of really thinking in terms of who you put in a staff role, ideally, a head instructor you'd like to have be an extrovert and a feeler. And ideally, you'd like a salesperson to be an extrovert and a judger. Why would you want a salesperson to be a judger? So they close the sale, right? A lot of you guys know Frank Brown. What Frank's biggest challenge is he was a perceiver, and so he was really great at all the different pieces, but oftentimes he wouldn't close a sale. So now he's left a conference, and the last piece of, like, you gave me a check and signed the contract didn't happen, right? And sometimes you'll find that. You put somebody in a role to be in a sales role, but lots of conversations happen without a definitive answer. If you find that happening, sometimes you got a perceiver in that role, somebody who just... their idea of the deal being closed is a definite maybe, right? You want to be careful about that. Is this making sense so far? So if you start to look how all these things interact.
Excuse me, Matt.
Yes.
I got my profile.
Oh, wow. They don't have a type for slow.
ESTJ.
Hey. Wow. We now have another ST.
We're the only two.
We're the two. We're both.
So we should have looked at the ESTJ piece, too. So ESTJ.
I'm sorry, ESTJ. Oh, that's wrong. I'll be the ESTP. Where's ESTJ?
There we go. That's page 188. So let's look at Sean.
I'm at the back of the book.
Yeah, they're all on the back of the book. Okay, so let's look quickly at ESTJ. I think you have the shortest description.
That's usually me. I'm not complicated. I'm about to tell.
We actually have all the questionnaires.
One more.
Yeah, we need to add those back, and then we'll get copies of those people. Okay, so So let's go through, kind of start on the left here. Let's make sure everybody knows each other. So Eric, stand up, introduce your lovely wife, and let's. You're an INTJ. Everybody who is an INTJ or an ENTJ, stand up. If you're an INTJ or an ENTJ, stand up. Interesting. So Eric, tell us about your personality type. What does the book say about you?
Tend to be kind of, like you said, rather be alone, introverted, like to get things done. I think it said we're responsive to those people we're not totally about. Is that right?
No. that was wishful thinking. Exactly. Okay. Expand on that, John.
We're driven by ideas more than realities.
Yeah.
So we're very flexible in the way that we think and the way that we perceive the way things ought to be.
Yeah.
We can to kind of work with those.
Right. Expand on that.
Take on responsibility, assume the leadership position, break from the norm if it makes sense.
Good.
Task driven, to get things done, and following logic much more than emotion.
Okay, good. Erica, explain to everybody just a little bit about your operation. Everybody else have a seat real quick.
School?
Yeah, tell them about you've got a very unique school, I believe, anywhere in the country. But tell them just a little bit about a thumbnail of where you're at, what you're trying to accomplish this year.
Okay, well, we teach primarily Chinese martial arts, Shaolin Kung Fu, Tai Chi, Chinese internal styles of Bagua and Shi, and Swai Jiao, which is Chinese grappling. So within the Chinese martial arts, we teach a variety of styles. Also, part of Kempo integrated into our Shaolin Kung Fu devices. And our student body is about two-thirds adults, one-third children. For years, we were just adults, but I think when we started with Matt, we started working with you about 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. At that time, we started the kids' programs. I think we average about currently between 300 to 350 students. Up until this past year, for the last 4 years, I had a fitness boot camp, but it just sort of dwindled down, so one of the things I'm doing is revamping a new one, and that's something I hope to get some feedback on here. And we bought our own property and built our building 10 years ago, so trying to get that paid off in the next couple of years. And I've been in the inner circle for 2 years, up until about 2 years ago, I think. One of the reasons I'm getting back in is I really want to, this year, boost things. I want to try to grow by about 25-30% this year.
Eric, I can't quite hear you.
Okay.
Say a little bit louder.
Trying to grow about 25-30% this year. And so I'm willing and doing whatever I can to push to make that happen.
And Eric, I think you undersold a little bit. Your campus is really interesting. Tell me a little bit more about your facility.
Yeah, we're on 12 acres. Building's 10,000 square foot building. Originally, we built it. We had it was really more of an Asian cultural center. We had a restaurant, gift shop, massage therapy, all that. We sort of phased all of that out just as our classes grew. The others didn't grow. Just as a business decision, we decided to focus on the martial arts. So it's a nice facility, and with any luck, we'll have it paid off in 2 or 3 years. And my next goal is we bought 10 acres up in the Carolina Mountains. I want to build a retreat center in 2 years, so I'm trying to earn as much cash as I can for that. And I think the other thing that I would say is maybe a little unique about us is both Deborah and I. Sort of, we run our school by a Zen philosophy, if you will. She's a Buddhist, I'm not, but I have adapted a lot of the Zen perspective on living a simple life. So neither of us are motivated, so anytime we get extra money, to us it's not about, oh, what can we get? We've always just thrown it right back into the school. We're just trying to make it a school-driven enterprise, and the retreat center is something I really want to do for my students to have that. And somewhat selfishly, that might become a retirement place where we spend a lot more time as well.
And in round numbers, you're running $750 a year right now.
Right.
Yeah. At one location. So good. So everybody welcome Eric back to the meeting here. And you introduced your wife briefly.
Deborah. Yep. She does all of her bookkeeping, and she's kind of like the school mom, if you will. She's always up front, receptionist, taking care of things. So she's kind of the go-to person for day-to-day stuff that drives me crazy. And I do the stuff that would drive her crazy, like the marketing and that kind of stuff.
Beautiful. And Jonathan. And then we're over here. So Jonathan's an INTJ, and Eric's an INTJ. So Jonathan, give everybody a little bit of your background.
I run a karate school in Connecticut. It's followed the economy, unfortunately. So it's followed the economy, unfortunately. So it's about 300 students 3 years ago. It's now down to the 200-ish mark. But my upgrade program is starting to ramp up, so my growth is still about the same. So that's kind of where I'm at, and I'd like to reverse the enrollment trend back to where I was before and keep the upgrade trend doing what it's doing. So that's my goal for this year.
And how long have you had the school?
I've had the school for 10 years as an owner, but I worked in it for 5 years prior because it used to be part of a franchise organization.
It was part of the United Martial Arts.
United Studios.
United Studios. Yeah.
The East Coast Division, which is like the Steve Damasco branch, rather than the West Coast Division, which is something else.
Tell them a little bit about United Studios, because it's an interesting backstory.
United Studios is actually several different organizations, because it was the George Pesario Kempo organization that sort of affected almost every Kempo school on the East Coast and really across the country to some degree, was United Studios' name. And then Fred Villari left them and started Fred Villari School of Self-Defense, which is a huge chain. And then Steve Damasco left Fred Villari and went back to the United Studios name, mostly to piss him off. But there's the old United Studios name, and there's the Steve Damasco United Studios, and then there's a West Coast operation, which operationally is completely different. So there's three different things there.
The one that is now split in United and the Ultimate.
The Ultimate. Although there's still Charlie Matera still runs some United Studios,
right.
But a lot of people left with the Ultimate.
Yeah.
So all three organizations still exist in one form or another. That being said, it was a franchise organization. It had some good things going on. Damasco was very proficient technically and was a good fighter, and he understood the concept that the martial arts is really about character development. And they tried to do some good things in terms of staff development and so forth. So, but the group that he had attracted were people kind of like him. They were kind of rough and interested in the fighting rather than people who were interested in developing businesses. So, he understood the next level. His group didn't. So it just didn't get where it should have. So that fell apart in 2000 and went out of business. And he's done that a few times. He's been out of business and restarted, and he's doing it again now. So that was an interesting experience because it allowed me to make some mistakes in someone else's clock and to sort of see what was going on. And actually, I was very successful in the environment. I doubled my school every quarter for three or four quarters, and then again in the third year, and took a school that had been failing for 2 years to almost where I am now in terms of enrollment. But no, to well beyond where I am now. I'm still. But I was at 300 students for about 9 or 10 years.
Yeah. So everybody, welcome Jonathan. It's, a lot of the business backstory on these things are interesting to get a sense of how we kind of ended up where we were at. Anybody remember listening to that interview I did with Pat Burleson? When we had Pat Burleson at wherever we were, where he was there, San Antonio, most of the martial arts business systems that we use today ended up bubbling out of the dance studio industry, right? So it was out of the...
Arthur Murray Clinic.
No, the other one, Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire and Arthur Murray. And if you trace the lineage all the way back, it's always been kind of interesting to me that Tracy's, Villari, United Studios tended to have a single school operator model, a lot of private lessons, small schools. And the Junry branch of it was kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum. although it probably best typified as, you know, if I wanted to generalize now, 3,000 square foot, 300 student target market. And, you know, for whatever reason, if you took it out of the dance industry, you had Pat Burleson many years ago interacting with June Ree, with Chuck Norris and Bob Wall, and with Ed Parker. And then all of these business systems kind of branching out of that single hub out of Texas, interestingly enough. But it always seemed like the Kempo side took a smaller footprint, smaller staffing model of that, where kind of the June Ree and the Chuck Norris and the June Ree organization used to model the Chuck Norris School in Virginia Beach. And the Chuck Norris School in Virginia Beach was, I don't know, 10 or 12,000 square feet, multiple classrooms, very, very, very successful school. It was, in fact, a location that Norris had great irritation and bitterness about for a while, because the owner was a racist and had some problems and had some negative publicity. And it was also, Chuck had signed a deal where he basically had, you know, given away use of his name for that purpose in perpetuity. So for many years, he had this Chuck Norris School that had all kinds of, in Virginia Beach, problems with, you know, excluding blacks and so forth. So it was an interesting kind of backstory. But the June Ree Institute in Washington, D.C. used to go model the Chuck Norris School there. And Pat Burleson had been the one who helped Joe Lewis get out of his partnership with Bob Wall, helped Chuck Norris come into the partnership with Bob Wall, helped them grow to, I think, when they went from one school in Sherman Oaks to about 5 locations, and then went on to about 9 locations before that imploded, and then Chuck Norris went into acting. So it was, you know, there's some interesting backstory there, but you can also kind of see the evolution of the business model of how we operate things if you go back to what we know where it came from. What it also shows you right now with the MMA evolution is the MMA evolution, and it's not the first time it's happened in the industry, but a lot of it is kind of like back to the 60s if you have a long-term perspective, because a lot of the new guys coming in with a wrestling background or in some cases a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu background who are now doing an MMA school are looking at the fitness industry model as the model for how they're doing it, rather than, you know, what I think of as our model, as the dance school model. And it's easy to typify. In the latest magazine, I have an article about whether you want to be Walmart or the Apple store. You know, and if you know the backstory, Apple, their sales per square foot is $5,600 per square foot in the Apple store. So the number one per square foot retail. Number two in the world is Tiffany's, which is at like 3,000 square foot. Apple's 5,600 square foot. In contrast, Best Buy is about 900 a square foot, 960. And a different way to think about it is that if you take what I'll call the dance industry model, it's about a high revenue per student. And you take the fitness center model, it's about huge volume. And in the martial arts industry, generally, I believe that it's hard to do enough volume to run a model where you're going to look at, the average student is going to be $30, $40 a month. I have seen it done. There's a big facility in San Antonio, Krav Maga School. And he's running what used to be, if you were familiar with service merchandise, it used to be a service merchandise store, huge facility. Interesting, though, it has about 3 hours a night of classes. And so it has like 5, 6, and 7 with like 4 things going on at once, running what he says is 2,000 active students. What in reality he means is 2,000 people whose EFT is going through on a regular basis, right? But he's got a price point of $39 a month and $89 a month. $89 a month if you want to be in Krav Maga, $39 if you just want to have a membership and running big numbers. But I have rarely ever see that work in the martial arts industry. And the way you have to do it in the martial arts industry is not really have a curriculum, just have classes. And that's where, and Carol can attest to this, the Krav Maga organization, in my view, the leaders of that organization have a fitness industry model focus. So they think in terms of volume, not quality. They're thinking in terms of quality of curriculum, meaning how badass you are, not quality of curriculum, meaning how long you keep students and how far they've progressed. So it's interesting to always look at the backstory of this and look at how it evolved. So, Mike?
I worked for Jonathan actually for many years.
Yeah.
Straight out of high school. Got out of martial arts for a little while, did some sales, and actually took over a family chemical school a few years ago, which I thought was a great idea.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, it did. So, you know, it's been a lot of tinkering and, you know, really working on the culture of the school, bringing in a new direction, and it's been a lot of, it's been many years of tinkering inside the studio. So we have about 120 active students, gross 250, and really relatively low marketing. You know, thought it was a good idea, but looking back, if I had started from scratch, you know, it's a very different, I think, be in a very different spot. But this is the first time I was able to completely focus on it, growing the business as a business.
Well, good. And you're an ENTJ, so a lot of ENTs in here. And then Mike. Let's welcome Mike. We have a lot. Too many Mikes. Four Mikes.
We operate two.
Is this Mike affinity? We have the two Mikes at this end and two Mikes at this end. We've got to figure this out.
Stereo.
Yeah. Exactly.
I was here first, huh?
That's right. You were here first.
This is my first association with Batman and the group here, so it's nice to meet everybody. I currently operate two schools right outside of Philadelphia, in the process of getting the third one open. And just to talk about, like, the main location, we've been open for 16 years. And we kind of have that volume thing going versus revenue. We're going to kind of balance that or raise the revenue. We have 450 students after the week taking classes at the main school, and we averaged about 70,000 per month throughout last year. January this year, that spiked a little bit. It's our highest gross ever. It was 81. And what we're looking to do is kind of either balance out the square foot numbers similar to the Apple Best Buy location, like knock that 450 down to 300 in the process of raising tuition, or kind of keep the high active count but also raise the tuition.
Yeah, the second one's a better goal.
The second is a better
goal. I think it'd be equal. Number two.
We used to be a fairly traditional Kempo school back 10 or more years ago. And recently we're probably much less traditional and focusing more on fitness, kickboxing type of drills with our adult classes and our kids while still maintaining, you know, all the character development features of it. You know, it's a healthy social environment for everybody. We have a lot of families at the school, and I think that's our strength. So we're just looking to raise the value so we can raise the tuition. Full speed ahead.
Good. Well, welcome, Mike. And by the way, Mike said something interesting there. A few of you heard this before, but many, many, many years ago, probably mid, late 80s, is... In the same situation, the first school I opened, at the time I had five, but the first school I opened was 2,500 square feet. We were running about 550, 575 active. And, you know, having an educational background in economics is, you know, I was looking at price elasticity of demand, thinking that because I had a space limitation problem and I had a staffing problem. The staffing problem was fairly easy to fix, and the space limitation problem we could expand, which I did, which turned out to be a mistake. But my solution was raise the prices 20%, assuming that the volume was going to drop off 20%. The gross would be the same, but everything else is going to work out fine. And every time I raised the prices, the enrollment went up. And so, you know, my experience in the past, and this is now replicated over, you know, quite a few schools, well over 100, is looking at the numbers. As the prices go up, usually the enrollment goes up, not down. Okay. Now, the transition is tricky, right? So as you transition the existing people, Eric is one of the few that I know of who very successfully just told everybody the price is going up, and everybody nodded and went along with it. But in most cases, it's create the next new thing and renew a whole bunch of people into the next new thing, right? So, and in fact, you know, we're in the acquisition of Navna, we're now trying to take our own advice because we've been a lot of somebody in their circle, Penny, who's not here, made reference to a lot of like the lower level materials. What we do with Inner Circle Peak Performers is we just mail you guys everything. But a lot of the stuff that's at the lower level like really isn't as sophisticated as we would want you guys to use. And the behind the scenes debate is, well, we ended up with a company with hundreds of legacy members, if you will, you know, old people who were used to paying a very small amount of money to get what I considered a lot of times to be, you know, moderate level material. And so now the question was, is do we go to work on high level copywriting, high level, you know, creation for stuff that mostly they're not going to use anyway? Or do we create a whole new track of stuff just for the higher level people? And an awful lot of what we're focused on exclusively now is create the high level people that we can educate enough so that they use quality stuff. So it's, you know, everybody deals with the same thing, right? Really it should be if you're at 450 people and you double the revenue per student, the account stays the same or goes up, right? So you don't want to think about those, you know, having that kind of correlation. So let's go to DC here. Carol, you want to talk, introduce your...
Okay, we have four programs. The oldest is karate school, and we never really got above 180, and then the economy went down. Right now it's down to 122, active account. And partly also suffered from when I started crawling off, and spent a lot of time on that, and but it's a lot in the karate school, which I wanted to reverse this year and spend a lot more time building up the karate school. The Krav Maga really suffered from the downturn in the economy. We went from almost 600 students to a little bit over 300 students now, which is not enough to pay. Basically, we also had a crisis in the Krav Maga school last year where chief instructor left. We didn't think he was paid. He always wanted to do something. And out of nine instructors, eight of them left. And we're left with one. He's now doing this part-time at $50 an hour. He's doing his part-time job, which is 12 hours a week. And at $50 an hour, we're not paying him. And, so we're in difficulty with the Krav Maga school and in the process of suing the people that completely didn't honor their non-compete agreement, and we have to go through this lawsuit. It's wasting a lot of my time. It's just the way it is. And then I have the kickboxing program, which is a Krav Maga school, and it was like bringing in $8,000 worth of new people a month, which is great. And then I raised the price, and I think we got 60 intros this month and 0 ago. So we have to really change how we're setting up those prices and how we're selling. And then we have a full contact self-defense program called Impact, which is called Non-Lane. And it never did bring in a lot of money, but it has a huge impact on the community. And women who learn self-defense, and sometimes men, and sometimes teens, can learn in a 25-hour class and it's over. And but they really are ready. So those are our four programs.
Well, your Krav school has been consistently what, 600,000 to 700,000 a year? Is that about right?
Yeah, over there.
Yeah. So maybe 750. So in a very high profile, very expensive, very prime DC location. So you're right off Chinatown, right by the train station. What's your rent? 25,000 a month?
It's 24,000 a month. We're right in Chinatown, and we're in the building with. Metro.
Yeah. So very, very prime location. Yeah. I mean, there's pluses.
New York,
right? But a location that needs to be doing 150 a month for all the numbers to work right. So it is capable of doing it. I mean, it's one of those few locations, probably in the United States. That, you know, like Showman's location in Manhattan, where, I mean, legitimately could be a $200,000 a month location. But the challenge is, with that kind of cost per square foot, it has to be a very high revenue per person location. Not, you know, it can't be 2,000 people. It has to be, you know, $300 per person per month. And So that's what we're working on. And Carol is an INTJ, interestingly. So Sean,
yes, sir.
As one of the few STs in the room, stand up and introduce yourself.
I'm from Bermuda, as you may be aware, if you're not, then it's there. It's a very small country, a very wealthy country. I'm going through some hard times right now. We're lagging the American economy. But without our transition this last year, so it's kind of hard to take statistics on it because we're going through a transition. But we're at, in the beginning of the year, we were at probably at 180, but we had a different price point. Maybe we're at 180. Now we're at 160. We're climbing back. One of our biggest problems was the fitness kickboxing. So we changed it to a coaching model, which in the beginning it was, you know, we had a legacy. People who would come in from our fitness kickboxing and strictly looking for things like Zumba. I mean, you know, we're now having a huge argument against Zumba, so we're kicking Zumba's butt. I know we're recording this. I meant to say the other word, but you know, we're kicking Zumba's butt, right? And because of the coaching program and because of what we've created, so the price point at kickboxing is $297, and we're getting that. And we have our coaching program is at like $497.
Have you launched the $997 thing yet?
Sorry.
Have you launched the higher level above that yet?
$997. I haven't had a chance to hit that yet because we were. Just try and make sure that we got the verbiage right. So, you know, we did some stuff that we should have done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We went back to the basics, and that's what's really what's been closing the deals. In our jiu-jitsu side, where our black belt clubs are $347. So, it just took us time to get there because we were adjusting the prices. So, I think another year or two, we would really know, you know, where we stand, but. You know, we're doing really, really well. I mean, there are a lot of businesses going out of business around us. Been in business 7 years and going out of business. We've been making a profit every year. So, you know, I'm happy. You know, I don't have to deal with the taxes you guys pay. we're having a good time. I think that, you know, doing this stuff here is going to really help me to get it to the next level. I think we can easily get to a million. Year. I mean, I'm only looking for 200 members. I'm not looking for a lot. I'm looking for volume. I don't have volume. You know, we got 60,000 people, say 70,000 people in Bermuda. Some of the Americans have left because of the insurance. But the economy is changing in Bermuda, where it's becoming more and more competitive. So and we're picking up on that climate.
Yeah, well, you were predominantly the insurance industry, which took a big hit with AIG and one thing or another. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I mean, I'm looking to get people who are really interested, highly focused. But that was one of the things I put down there is that I just want to find information that will. I think we're getting, but you know, any insight or increasing the value outside of just doing jiu-jitsu. Well, yeah, I do jiu-jitsu. That's what I do for a living. That's my martial art. Also, people don't want to just use jiu-jitsu. They want more. They want more value. You know, that's the most important piece.
You bet.
And obviously, I'm ESTJ, which means that I just read that I like to stick to the rules, and so that's why.
Oh wait a minute! You're the first personality change we've hit here. So explain ESTJ to everybody. And Bob, where'd Bob go? Bob. He's done all the other.
Yeah, ESTJ from here. It was saying that we're very sticklers on the rules, so that's probably why when you tell me to get something done, I go do it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the weaknesses I saw in there was that we sort of jumped the gun a little too soon, mm-hmm. because you know, and you got to sit back and listen a bit more. But the main thing is that we're very loyal and honored, and it's good for everyone. What I need in order to become that. $1 million because it's not about being the smartest guy in the room, it's by taking the instructions and doing what you're supposed to do to get there, which I think is the most important piece.
Everybody's
fabulous.
Everybody's a J.
Yeah. They don't have any. They don't have any.
The only note I didn't have is how many do you have in kickboxing right now?
Kickboxing now, we got 70 ladies.
70 ladies?
Yeah, we're trying to get 100. I'm sorry.
How many?
70. Yeah.
But then, think about the numbers for a second in relative terms. Is you're doing 500,000 a year right now with, what, 200 active students?
Right now we have 167.
So 500,000 on 167. Yeah. And on the current growth rate, 1 million this year.
That's what we're shooting for.
With maybe 250, 280 students. So, I mean, think of the ratio there. And that, you know, I mean, that's U.S. dollars. I mean, it's not, you know, there's not. It's interesting. Everybody I talk to internationally, I've heard, and we have several Canadians who aren't here today, but the Canadians, and Sean just said it, the Australians all tell me that they're lagging the U.S. economy. Well, the U.S. economy is lagging the U.S. economy. Right. Yeah, I got to tell you. You know. So, you know, we're not having the Reagan recovery, I got to tell you. This is it's interesting. But, Joe, introduce yourself, and we might as well go back to everybody who's an NF. So we have... Well, Robert, is that you or your wife? Who's the NF in the team over there? Okay, so Dave is an NF, and Mike is an NF, and Mike is an NF. So let's have all the NFs stand up. And you guys, Joe, tell us about your personality type a little bit.
Well, before, wait a minute, let us sit down.
What is this? Mike sit together and NF sit together?
Mike? Yeah.
I didn't.
Hey, Mike, sit down a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
While everybody was talking, I took the test one more time.
Did you?
I got to resubmit the whole thing.
You got what?
XXTP.
XXTP.
There's no X.
X.
Can be either E, me, or if they're even.
Haven't said that.
Oh, it was like, it was 10 to 10. It was 10 to 10.
Yeah.
Wow. I did that the first time I did.
So everybody welcome our schizophrenic in the room.
I mean, every time you answer those questions, it's come somewhat of a, to me, how am I feeling today?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then what's
you're a P then, right?
Yes.
See, that's his problem. He can't decide.
Yeah, so.
Okay, so what?
TP. XXTP.
TP.
The instructions, though, I know we can get into it, but if you read the book, it says if you get even,
right,
you want to read the first two paragraphs of each description and see which one kind of fits you better.
Okay.
But, you know.
That's well, he must then be an S, not a T, because he can't read the directions. And a P, not a J, because it's having a hard time deciding.
Which, by the way, is one of the things that we used to do with, there's this test. I can't remember. It's not Kersey, but it's, I think it's PJ and Erickson that put it together, right, for kids. And the instructions say, it's like 20 questions, 10 in the front, 10 in the back. And the instructions say, please read all the questions first, then go back and start answering them. And the very last one says, just turn your paper over and you're done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just to see if anybody actually reads through them all first.
Right.
And nobody does, but, you know, it's like 1% of the people actually follow the damn instructions.
Go ahead, Joe. So you just opened your second location.
Yes, and
came up with opened it with a bang.
Yeah, it opened up really strong, and we actually enrolled from the time I started enrolling, which is about a month ahead of opening the doors to month in, enrolled 100 students. And that was amazing, and the marketing plan that Master Oliver put together with me, and it just worked like a charm. But also...
You spent about
$20,000? About $20,000 in marketing, spread over about 3 months' time.
Yeah.
Right?
And I told you 35 in 6 weeks.
But I also found out really quickly that something else Master Oliver told me is that when I get removed from my other location, that it's going to drop. And that's the problem I'm facing right now, is that the guy that I left in my position is doing a great job with enrollment, but there is no upgrade. Literally, they've gone. We've done two since I opened my new location. And that's horrible. And
what was that?
September. And that's only because I went over there and did them. You know? And so I have to put together a system. And our system
locations,
for...
Man.
What's
yeah.
that?
Yeah, we'll get there.
Locations, man.
Yeah. Right.
And
the worst number possible.
But, you know, doing well, despite the economy. the demographics between my first school and this one are night and day, even though it's only like a 12-minute drive. New location has a higher population density, almost double the median income.
Is it still in Hempstead or no?
No, it's in Westminster. It's
Westminster, that's right. Okay.
Literally a 12-minute drive with a little bit of traffic. So it's very strange, actually. We're in a brand new shopping center that's our high-end shopping center, but surrounded by two high-end neighborhoods. So the word's getting out, growing quickly. And total enrollment with those schools around 350. And I wish I could give you better stats, but I use Perfect Mind now, and
it's not perfect.
It's not set up for health clubs, but it's good.
It has a lot of potential, but it's not perfect, set up for that's for sure. And
that's why I keep all manual stats. We use that too.
Oh, Perfect Mind.
Champions.
Yeah. Not Mind Body.
Okay. That's a big word.
Yeah, I mean,
the
potential.
But before you finish that thought, there's a lesson buried in there. Is no matter what software you're using, we're running a very simple business, okay? And at all ends of the spectrum, a friend of mine was the president of a $780 million, I think when they peaked, electronics chain. And it's called Ultimate Electronics, so they're kind of throughout the Midwest. And they shifted to a new software system that literally put them out of business. And so they spent millions of dollars. I mean, it's a big operation, millions of dollars. And ultimately, the guy working on the floor, and they sell TVs and, you know, stereos and one thing or another. And they were in like, you know, 100,000 square foot, very upscale facilities.
Like Best Buy, kind of.
Well, not higher end than Best Buy. They were like Magnolia. Have you seen Magnolia and Best Buy? That's one of their old guys. Their chief operations guy is the one who did Magnolia and Best Buy. So, but they put in a new software system, and it put them out of business because they literally just didn't know what was going on. And there really is a lesson to martial arts schools. I created much way before Fareed was doing anything of substance. Very high-end software package to run the schools years ago. Probably $150,000 in programming fees and thousands of hours. And we never knew what was going on better than a manual ID card system and a clipboard at the front desk, you know, ticking things off. And you've got to make sure you keep software and automation in its place. There's an article. I may have sent it to you guys. Did I send you that Don't Automate, Obliterate article? If not, there's an article I'll send you. It's called Don't Automate, Obliterate. And if you've seen the book Reengineering, the whole big companies went through the whole reengineering was the buzzword a few years ago, but it was a Harvard Business Review article that led to the book that led to that trend. But one of the things it said is big companies try to automate systems that don't work already. And so rather than try to automate things that don't work already, you know, blow it up, re-engineer it before you do anything. But in a martial arts school, I mean, if you don't just write down how many intros you had and how many of them enrolled and have a little manual way to go through the ID card system, a lot of times you lose track. And the human mind works differently, where most people can't look at a page of numbers and understand what's going on. So for staff, you need a graph for them. So you, in many cases, you need to put it in a picture so that they can understand what's going on. So you want a few key numbers that are graphed. You also want a few key numbers. I tell a story about, you know, Keith Hafner's school. When they were hitting their biggest numbers, he had a little piece of white paper on the wall next to the office, and there was always a number on it. And what the number was is how many people were in their intro pipeline at one time. So what he meant by the pipeline is they had called and had an appointment come in for first, had been in for first, had an appointment to come in for a second, or were still coming back in for maybe a third to enroll. So the people who were in the pipeline. And they had a target number that everybody on staff knew what it needed to be. And at the time, I think it was like 15, right? So if that number was below 15, they knew they had a marketing problem. But see, if you need a small number of simple numbers that everybody knows and keeps track of, and you've got to be very careful about letting computers rule the world, because, you know, they're not very smart, right, ultimately. But anyway, well, welcome, Joe. Back. And then Robert, another NT.
We're from New York. I have a school that took over about 4 years ago now, four and a half. That was basically not in business. We had about 38 students doing about 4,000 a month.
Yeah.
Last year was a record year for us. We did close to 400,000 last year. This year is off to a tear. We've taken the school since April of last year. We're at about 128 active. My stats as of this morning from my program director, we're at 262 active. We're on track to do about 45,000 this month, 46,000 this month.
Well, your second half of the year was about double your first half. Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. From April through January, we did 35,000 plus every month.
Yeah. Good. And you're another NT here. Robert, tell me a little bit about your background. You came into the school because you came from IBM.
The school was a part-time thing.
Yeah.
My parents owned it. It was something I always wanted to do. It was never the career choice, per se. I had spent a few years with IBM, worked my way up, you know, to a team lead. And my job got sent to Brazil. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I had a conversation about, you know, whether I wanted to go looking for something, and for me, pretty much the only option would have been New York City, honestly, at that time, which the travel down and back, I mean, the money would have been good, but I would have never seen my family. I had a young son at the time. And, you know, we made the decision to try to make a run at the school. I bought the school from my father, and we kind of went from there.
You're about 90 minutes north of the city.
Not even, probably about an hour.
About an hour.
How long did you drive?
To West Point?
It's across the street from him, yeah.
Okay.
It looks like it's fun.
Yeah, it's not. Okay. It's not. It's pretty close.
Probably the evening, that second evening we're there, we're perhaps trying to maybe go catch a couple schools.
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course. So we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah.
I don't know what's...
There's a couple guys that are pretty close. So.
Who are you looking to go see?
Maybe Danny's school.
Danny.
Show me.
That'd be Paramus.
How far out is that?
Paramus, New Jersey?
That's about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Yeah, hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah.
I was going to say, there's not much where we are that's big.
No, Hudson Valley is pretty isolated. I mean, it's up the...
Yes.
Yeah. I'm an hour from your school. I timed it when I came through the last time.
Yeah. I think Don's going to come up with us when we come up there. So.
He's not still living out there, right? He's out in Denver?
He's in Denver, yeah. He just moved from San Diego.
Or Korea. Yeah, either one.
Yeah. Whichever
week it is. Denver, San Diego, and Seoul. So.
I'm Dave Moss. I'm from Virginia. And I used to run, Charlie Lee's Karate School in Herndon. My wife got pregnant with triplets. She's a patent attorney, and I made a fraction of what she made, so I quit my job, stayed home, took care of the kids. A year later said, I gotta go do something. So I opened up the school in Ashburn, Virginia, and we're at right around a little under 300, like 270-ish. We did about 400, just short of 400,000 last year. I'm in a warehouse space, but I have a bunch of like kid activities there with me. So I have like a dance school, a music school, Gold's Gym. There's a bunch of stuff in there with us. So that's, you know, we have 9,000 square feet. I want to.
How much are you doing with transport after school here right now?
I have about 75 after school kids.
Yeah. Who else is doing that right now in here? So you're doing a little bit.
Paul is not here, obviously.
Yeah, Paul and Alex. We're missing Paul and Alex. Paul and Alex are new to the group. Don't sit down yet, Dave. But it was a side tangent. You're an INF. So tell us about your personality.
I am an introvert. I definitely leave the karate school and go turn off everything and don't. And I am definitely a feely person.
And you're joined by Mike and Mike. So Mike, expand upon that, Burns.
I mean, this concept of being an introvert and, you know, running a large organization, you know, I think to myself that 4 weeks ago I was emceeing our awards banquet. We've got 400 people there. I'm up there. I'm telling jokes. It's all planned out. I'm emceeing things. We got a top 10 humorous list, and I'm doing all that. And I'm just so happy when all that's done, so I can just go sit at home, you know, and be there. I told
you do
them,
it.
And I do it. And somebody said, "Oh, you're so good at this. You're a natural." I said, "No, that's my role and my responsibility for this organization."
Yeah.
And I planned for it for the year, but when it's done,
I like when they say you're such a natural.
Oh yeah, I'm such a natural.
Oh.
No. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a different personality test, because my banquet, we have about 400 people, and I just love it.
Yeah.
I just really love doing it.
Yeah. Because you're an extrovert. And the reason I circle the middle two is the middle two really determine the primary personality.
Well, in the exam, by the way, the first one, the first introvert extrovert only has 10 questions. The other one has like 20. So does the next one. So does the next one. You know what I mean? So it's easier to figure out.
Yeah.
More detailed.
Yeah.
The second one's more
detailed. Yeah. So Mike, expand on the NF personality from there.
Well, me or which Mike? Me?
Either one.
Oh.
there's four of you, so.
Well, you know, it said that, you know, we're good, you know, we're good leaders, managers, and I kind of think that fits me. Mm-hmm. You know, we care about people, we're empathetic, and, you know, I kind of feel that's how I am.
Yeah. You know, if you and again, I mean, we have a fairly tight subset here. But NTs tend to be build a big picture, the abstract model, you know, the architect. NFs tend to be better supervisors of implementation of that, right? So NFs have inherently, unlike what Eric tried to inject into NT, is NFs have inherently more empathy for the people, more empathy for where their emotional state is with it, for what it's going to take to, you know, to motivate them to do it, as opposed to give them the model for, you know, what to do and just kind of expect them to implement. And you know, what I've always said, you know, my strength and weakness is, I went through this in a huge battery. My third black belt was a PhD in psycholinguistics, which is a fancy way of saying a psychologist with educational background, and you know, early on in the 80s, I started doing what I considered to be like an informal PhD in different subjects that interested me. And the first one was educational psychology. And and as part of that, he ran me through the whole battery of tests. And his conclusion was, I was really the type of personality that was good at spearheading on an abstract basis, on a conceptual basis, a big organization, and really bad at dealing with the people on a day-by-day basis to get it to implement, right? So not the person who was really good, which fits several of you in the room. Jonathan, Mike, Eric, all good at picturing the outcome and the big picture and how it's all going to work together, and probably fairly irritated with dealing with the assistant part-time instructor that's not, you know, implementing well. Where you guys are going to be better at having that level of empathy with those people, holding their hand a little bit more, and dealing with that on a more day-to-day basis. And I'm sure, Robert, you two, you and your wife have the opposites in that you probably get irritated with people more quickly than she does and has a little bit more empathy and holding their hands than you do.
Somewhat.
Is that a fair statement? And Mike, you haven't introduced yourself. Right. You've got a personality. So,
Mike Martins from World Class Taekwondo Centers in Buffalo, New York. I'm originally from Syracuse, New York, which is remarkably a hotbed of martial arts. For how small a town it is! It's where Master Ramirez is from, where Master Tierney is from.
Yeah.
I moved from Buffalo 18 years ago. Working with my original instructor, Korean Grandmaster, we went on to become partners We operate 5 schools. We are what maybe Master Oliver would tell you now, and we will tell you now, don't aspire to become a big box, big number, you know, big operation. I can't say don't aspire to become, but, you know, it's as much headache as you would think it is. So we're running 5 locations, about 2,000 students, you know. I already discussed with Grandmaster Oliver that because I do have a partner who may feel differently on some of these areas, we don't talk our operational numbers as we'll talk any operational process, but numbers-wise, maybe not so much. But can comfortably say, yes, we do gross several million every year, and more of it goes out than I would like. we are definitely profitable, but like to see that improve. You know, all that being said, we didn't grow to this size by our guys not being good at what they do. We've got, you know, phenomenal facilities. Grandmaster Chung's visionary leadership has been a huge part of it. I tend to be the right-hand man, you know, that puts all the details in place, crosses all the T's, dot all the I's. But we've got phenomenal facilities. We've got phenomenal staff. We've got good staff training. Perhaps the most earth-shattering thing that I heard from Grandmaster Oliver within the last month was, well, obviously you're just vastly undercharging. and that may have been a great interpretation of our whole situation, because otherwise things are going, you know, I would say pretty well. I'm very happy this last year we were up across the board for all 5 of our schools. We opened one just 14 months ago, so that's a new one, and that's gone well. So we do have solid systems in place. We've got very solid people in place. We may just be vastly undercharging.
How many
60.
60 staff?
Yes.
Paid?
Paid.
How many of those are full-time?
Full-time, 15, I think, including we have at any given time a certain number of Korean nationals that we've recruited from Korea. We have 2 interns right now. I know they may become full-time employees at any time. At any given time, we have to run a little fat because we have people going out and coming in, you know, the next level. We have 15 affiliated schools, which are our former staff, who now run, you know, successful other. So you may come across other world-class Taekwondo centers. We do have some in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, yeah. Indianapolis, California. I'm sorry?
Do they all have the Buffalo?
That's right. Toby's actually been to one of our locations. But
I think 3 or 4 of them that day.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You were trying to find one, and you found the other 3. So
you can't drive in Buffalo, New York without running into at least 1 or 2 of them.
Right, right. Apparently. So
how many of the full-timers are Korean? Meaning they've
just... Korean nationals, yeah, 5.
Well, so head instructor,
basically the head instructor at each school. Language skills vary from conversational English at best to really not much more than what's necessary to run that class.
Okay.
That being said, I want to give extremely strong credit to... I mean, they spend on average... This isn't in and out in 2 years. I mean, we're one of the... In any of your given markets, you may have competed with schools that have Korean masters for a short period of time and go out. The average time spent with us is 6 or 7 years by the time their immigration is done. And of all of them, again, they've all gone off and established successful schools in the country, with the exception of 2 who decided to go back to Korea. But we have no failed former employees running schools in the United States because of the amount of time and effort. So they get there. But the initial level of conversational English is at best.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. The
wouldn't work without Grandmaster Chung, I would have to say.
Right.
I wouldn't ever recommend it. Although.
Oh, absolutely.
For which primary reasons? The culture connection.
The culture, the communication skills, obviously, are huge. Yeah. I mean, Grandmaster, you know, just like I run our staff meetings every single week, and Grandmaster Chung runs his staff meetings every single week. Which are on top of my staff meeting. So they sit through with whatever they understood of our business meeting, and then he has another 2-hour meeting and does it again to do that. And having somebody that has enough power to be able to break down some, just like these days with all the MMA guys, all of our Korean former national champions or international champions need to be ready to be eat a little bit of humble pie to go out and teach, you know, 6-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the... Since he has that national champion and U.S. coaching background, he can be able to tell them, that's wonderful, you won the Asian Games. Now, here's what I need you to do today.
Yeah. That was my question.
You know, honestly. Yeah.
That seems to be the biggest.
That takes a little... He's the best. You know, there are obviously horror stories of everybody, whether American Grandmaster or Asian Grandmaster, you know, not being able to have a lasting relationship, and there's a reason why. you know, we've been together for over 25 years. This is a very unique individual, and we're a pretty darn good team.
It was an interesting dynamic at the Junior Institute in the 70s, the same way, and it ended up being even stranger, because when the kickboxing thing came in, there were either very high-level Koreans that had come in that were on staff, or there were the Jeff Smith, Rodney Matisse, Mike Coles kickboxing group. And the Koreans that could acclimate and survive in that environment did very well, but an awful lot of them got chewed up pretty quickly. And it was a very interesting dynamic. And the and it's also interesting the role that you've managed to play in that, because Jeff Smith was your mm-hmm. was you in Junior's organization. But it was the role of, you've got the guy who's, you know, used to being best in his environment, then he comes in and gets thrown in with these other guys and getting them to mesh in the environment was an interesting situation. Mike, last Mike.
Okay. Mike Pace, New Jersey. I've been in business, I guess, 20-something years, 22 years. There was a time when we were running 350 students. Most of... When the market started to change, where it required hands-on type recruiting as opposed to ads and direct mail and so on and so forth, our enrollments started to really drop. And a lot of it was just, one, didn't know how to do some of that stuff, and two, was kind of unwilling to do some of it. You know, lifestyle to me has always been important, especially in the last 5 or 6 years. You know, probably, I don't know, 3, 4, I don't even know how many years before at some point I'll retire. I've been doing martial arts for be 45 years in June. So my situation is a little different. We own our own school. It's paid for. It's been paid for 5 or 6 years. Our net was only a little over 300, but we run about over 60%. Our gross was over 300, but our net is over 60% of because I run real lean staff, and I do a lot of teaching myself, and so it's a kind of a thing where I'm putting limited amounts of hours and time. I mean, this program has been real helpful to me, so because we've been able to learn how to, you know, get out of the model, the health club model, so to speak, and you know, we've consistently raised our tuitions, we've added several upgrade programs, and you know, developed a system now that's working really well. And basically, what I need to do is find a way to increase my enrollments without killing myself too much, you know. And a lot of that is just I'm just not, be honest with you, I'm just not really willing to do some of those things. And I, you know, I group, you know, I admit it. Yeah, I mean that's the thing, you know. So, you know, overall, I think this has been a great experience for me being in this group and learning the things that I've learned. And you know, without this system, I know that we wouldn't have been, you know, as far along as we are today.
Very good. So thank you, Mike. So let's expand from here for a little bit. I think it's and Bob was getting those copies done, right?
Yeah.
He had to leave.
Yeah.
Property to do that, huh? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's exciting. But you know, but moving along here, I think it's interesting to spend some time on the personality profiles, but also kind of understand the personalities of people in the room. And we're missing a few more than we thought we were going to be today. Paul and Alex.
Is Penny on the list?
Yeah.
She was on the list. We heard from her a couple of days ago. And Eric and Hi. A couple of days ago, they had all that drama with the new location. So
yeah.
Struggling through that,
Paul and Alex,
master testing,
who many of you haven't met, is they're outside of Philadelphia. Where exactly are they located? Basically, suburban Philadelphia. They interestingly used to be a Tiger Showman franchisee, they have three locations. In round numbers, doing about $4 million a year in three locations from transport after school care. And so their primary thing is approximately each of the three locations are around 10,000 square feet. They have, I'm trying to remember the numbers, but 186-ish kids in after-school care at one location, 126-ish at the next one, and I think about 100 at the next one. So charging somewhere between $400 and $500 a month for the transport after-school care, doing approximately $4 million between the three locations. And are kind of the opposite of what, you know, most people in the industry doing the after-school care are, is they came out of the Shulman operation, and I described it to them as throwing out the baby with the bathwater, kind of completely redid their martial arts program, but, you know, weren't in the daycare business, so they went about doing the after-school transport care and did everything right, and then when they set up the martial arts side of the thing, they did it all like, you know, hobbyists. And so one of the things they're doing is rebuilding the martial arts side. Now, the transport after school care, they're teaching karate. I mean, so they're doing a martial arts program as part of it, but are just kicking butt on financially on the after school care, both in terms of gross and a net. And then on the martial arts side, really, you know, haven't been doing much in terms of revenue with that. So fixing that, and then we're missing Eric and High. And on
their school program, by the way, they really do it right. I mean, they invest a lot of resources into high quality delivery. You know what I mean?
So oh yeah, yeah.
Substitute school teacher type folks who facilitate and.
Well, at their biggest location, the guy running it is a master's in education. Has a education management background in the school system, has several other people who are, you know, teaching certification and so forth. So they have a very high level staff. So I mean, this isn't a children's world with a bunch of hourly teenagers. In fact, one of the things we've talked about is a series of overlays of upgrades that you could do in that environment. So I had suggested, you know, my own thing, I said, like my daughter, if somebody charged me an extra $400 a month for, you know, full immersion, high intense, you know, second language education, Spanish, for instance, is that something I'd pay in a heartbeat. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to upgrade and overlay in that kind of context without it just being martial arts related.
Especially with the resources he has, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right, well, and he has, again, like you said, high-quality staff, high-quality systems in place. But now it's almost like just taking all the stuff that they do with school care and just clicking it on for the martial arts program at Russell Doubles. So, and then Eric and High. And Eric and High are in the middle of grand opening for location number two. That's what's going on this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're having some issues with staffing and stuff, but yeah,
join the club. What's that?
I thought they already had a second location.
They kind of did a soft open.
Yeah. Well, I may be confusing. Is this the internal kids facility that they're grand opening this week, or is it the additional?
Yeah,
I think that's what
space
it is.
Actually. Yeah.
So it's a kids facility. Adjunct to the current location. So it's not actually, you're right, they had the second location already, but this is kind of like if you want a third location. In their primary location, they finished the year about $1 million, I think. So their numbers, if I remember correctly, were 100 kids, 380 adult men. The adult men are predominantly doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. If I remember their split correctly, it's maybe 100 in Muay Thai and 300 in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, more or less, with some overlap between the two. And then they have a women's cardio program. I forget what their numbers are in the women's cardio program, maybe 100, and they have about 100 kids. So they have but, you know, the predominant focus is on adult men, 28 to 40, college educated, and now overlaying a kids program to the thing. I'd be amazed if they're not at $2 million this year. And you know, their problem has been high volume without having the revenue. So they've been 140, 150 a month, a lot of volume coming in the front door. They end up with like 140 intros a month right now, 100 to 150 intros a month. But they're at that one location. I don't know the numbers at the other location off the top of my head right now. But and then we're missing Penny, who's gone from three to five locations. And
Chris Bro.
Yeah, and Penny has been doing a lot of work with Terry Bryant. And Terry is very, very, very ill. I'm not sure he's expected to make it the next couple of months. I think they gave him 12 months to live 18 months ago. Before it had retreated or whatever, but it's a huge growth right here. I don't think he can talk. Last I knew, so he can't move his jaw. She's in San Antonio, opened two schools with Terry and his wife in San Antonio to try to help his wife out. But she's essentially running five locations right now, three in St. Louis, two in San Antonio. So if you can imagine, five locations in one area now make them in two cities that are a plane flight from each other. And then Chris Bro, we're in New York, is he? But he's suburban New York City, doing about $750 a year right now. And who else are we missing today?
Chris 732.
B-R-O-U-G-H.
Was he at the last meetings in Denver?
No. He's new.
No, I didn't
know. No.
That was different Chris. That was Chris Donovan.
But anyways, who else were? Is that it for this?
Yeah, I think it's it.
Yeah. Okay. And who all in here did the little behind the scenes Disney yesterday? Was that worthwhile?
Yeah.
Is that interesting? Okay. Well, Mike didn't.
Yeah, I couldn't come back.
Oh, that's
yeah. Right. I modified a family trip to be here, so I'm in Tampa right now.
Yeah.
Sunny. Warm.
This is a Lowry Park suit.
So there you go. Did you guys find it interesting? We will not spend much time on it today, but we'll spend a lot of time tomorrow morning. Okay, we're going to have Mike McCoy come over tomorrow at 10, and we'll spend 2 or 3 hours behind the scenes talking about what you guys picked up, some of what our observations are. Who has gotten a chance to read that book? Several. Several of you, and this is another interesting one. What was that book you just had?
Yeah,
I haven't read it, but it looks good. Yeah. See, if first glance, the other book is The Disney Approach to Services, The Disney Approach to Leadership. So, 10 Common Sense Leadership Strategy from a Life at Disney. So that looks really good, Lee Cockerell. Yeah, I haven't read that one.
Did you get that at the park?
Yeah, it was at the park.
Yeah. They actually have a pretty, a couple of the shops here at Downtown Disney have a pretty good selection of the Disney business books. Interesting. So,
now tomorrow's plan, are we going to be with the Peak Performance or separate?
We're going to do both. We're going to be together in the morning on Disney and then split up. So right after we get done on the Disney stuff, we'll send them to lunch. We'll stay together. And then they're doing a late evening tomorrow. We're doing a fairly short day tomorrow. Okay. So anyway, moving along, let's talk about, since we have a new mixture in the group here to start the year. Let's talk about a couple of things from a standpoint of, it's been addressed several times, but I want to talk about kind of the interesting cluster of personalities in the room. And I had said to Toby last night, I said, it's either a marvelous opportunity or presents a marketing problem, one or the other. What do you make of so many people being one of two personalities, either NS or NTs? How would you conclude what that means? If you look around the room and you have a fairly small group of people who are fairly elite school operators, and all of a sudden they kind of have self-sorted themselves into one of a couple of personalities, what does that mean?
Either we're the ones who are dumb enough or smart enough to run schools.
Yeah, it could be one of two things. It could either be based upon however we got you in the room, we're attracting that person. Or it could be the people who are rising to that level tend to be that. And it's probably a combination of the two, right? If I were looking at a martial arts school and looking at that assessment, and this is a little different because, you're now talking about business owners, and so there's a certain type that's going to rise to the top, right? But if I was looking at a martial arts school and found a whole bunch of one type of person, is I would give it an initial assessment of a couple things. One is I've heard Bill Clark and Sergio Van Smelling say this, which was each of their schools tend to be a whole bunch of people who look like whoever the instructor is, right? And so as you get into multiple school operations, one of the challenges is to keep it from being that key personality is what the school ends up being, and if that key personality is gone, the people don't fit with that person very well, right? So that's one of the challenges in multiples, is to, you know, guard against that becoming too dominant. On the other hand, there's a good argument to be made that there's a small number of personality types that are going to be dominated by people who rise to the top in any industry, including this one. And so therefore, and what I would expect to find is I would expect to find, like, the bigger multi-schools or the bigger, more interesting operations might tend to be dominated by INTs or ENTs, or anyway, ENTs, just because that's kind of an architectural personality. For all of the ENTs, you might be interested in going and looking at, what's our guy, the Chuck E. Cheese?
Gene Landrum.
Landrum. You might go look at Gene Landrum's early books. Gene Landrum's early books, his doctoral thesis was on the Promethean personality. Promethean means NT. And so he's written like 17 books, but all of them are really the same theme, which is there's a certain personality that have had great entrepreneurial success over the years. And he's looked at everybody from, you know, recent cases like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates to Howard Hughes. And he's also transformed into like historical figures. But his basic premise is that the NT personality is responsible for almost all major entrepreneurial successes internationally. So if you look at Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, Bill Gates are all, it's Jobs and Gates are both NTJs, right? Jobs was more of an ENTJ and Gates was more of an INTJ, but basically they're, you know, NT is the primary thing. And again, Toby's observation, other than Joe being schizophrenic, is that, you know, it's interesting that everybody in here is a J, although it's indicative, because people who tend to leave things open-ended have more difficulty with employee supervision and have more difficulty with sales. So if you have a 10-point to-do list, one of the things I remember most vividly about Eric over here is I walked into one of the meetings a couple years ago before I was, you know, running these, and he had a checklist of, what, 38 points that he had put together from the previous meeting that he wanted to get done, and he had checked off like 37 of the 38 points. It was just like, you know, I mean, usually what happens is we hear people who put together their checklist of everything they want to do, and they've gotten three of them done, and he had gotten 37 or 38 of 38 done. Is that about what the list was?
Something like that.
I mean, it was just amazing. But that's, you know, that's in part having a closer personality, right? Now, you can have a closer personality and be dumb or lazy. So, again, remember there's, you know, that the personality isn't everything. You've got to look at, you know, how IQ points are and whether somebody has work ethic. But it is an impressive piece of it. But overall, from a bigger organization standpoint, this is it's very useful for staff training, because what all teachers do is they teach well the people of the same personality types. Okay, because if they're halfway decent, the golden rule is do unto others as you'd have done unto you. Well, that's a misnomer, right? Is it should be, you know, do unto others as they would have done unto them, right? And as a teacher, you want to teach to the learning style of the student, not teach to the learning style of the teacher. And so what you find in education, and in general education, it said here in the front of the book, but what it say, in general education, you look at, there's a whole section on teaching in here, by the way. I think SF has a tendency to be what most school teachers are. But what you find is in the general teaching establishment is teachers, here we go, SJ. The vast majority of school personnel are SJ, followed by NF, right? So what you find then is if it's an SJ or an NF teacher, that other students who learn at that level do very well, right? But the typical school teachers, as all the NTs know in here, tend to irritate the NTs a little bit, right? Because they move too slow and they're too empathetic and they're, you know, not detailed enough. I mean, there's all kinds of things that don't fit. So from a teaching standpoint, we're not going to even cram a week of training into a 20-minute conversation. But from a teaching training standpoint, it would be probably useful for everybody. Give all your staff this test. Give them a copy of the book. Make it a 4-5-week project to get them to understand it a little bit. Have a little bit of discussion about how, you know, introverts and extroverts are different. So just because the kid is shy doesn't mean you need to get him out of his shell. It means you need to, you know, address him and work with him a little bit differently. See, a lot, extroverts, what do they think? Well, the quiet ones in the class, we got to get them to be extroverts. See, I mean, that's not what you want to try to do, right? You're not trying to turn introverts into extroverts. You're trying to get introverts to learn better. By the way, the upcoming presidential election, if I'll make an assumption that's going to irritate Toby, but if we end up with the election being Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, notice that it's interesting. We suddenly have two INTs running against each other. Think about past elections. The election thing, an awful lot of the elections are who would you like to go and have a beer with? Well, the thing of who you like to go out and have a beer with is mostly somebody who's a high extrovert, right? Clearly, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George Bush were all high extroverts, right? Bush Sr. would be an introvert. But, you know, you've got Bush, Clinton, and Reagan, all of who are, you know, who are very extroverted, right? I mean, very. And the thing that people you see, which is otherwise irrelevant, but in the media, a lot of times on both sides, you see Obama getting hammered for, like, not liking the Washington Party circuit. And you see Mitt Romney being hammered for not being, like, gregarious enough. Well, they're both very intellectual, both Harvard-educated, right? Romney's a Harvard-educated dual MBA JD, and Obama's a Harvard-educated attorney. Both introverts. My guess is both INTs. I don't know if J's or P's. My guess would be they're both INTJs. So it is an interesting. And then you look at the others in the Republican field, and I would definitely say Santorum and Paul are extroverts. I'm not sure where you put. I'm sure that Gingrich is an NT. I'm not sure where he fits otherwise. But it is kind of interesting to look on a national scale and look at how people are reacting based upon what it is, right? And in that kind of political role, it's unusual to see introverts, right? So it's unusual to see somebody who doesn't like to go glad handing. If you looked at the debates. Perry was obviously an extrovert, didn't do very well in the debates, but he was the guy who liked to be out shaking hands, and they said he was great at working a room, right? Honestly, Barack Obama, from everything I've read, and Mitt Romney, neither one are very natural at working a room. They're more like what you described, Mike, is, you know, they can do the deal, but they don't enjoy doing the deal, right? So it's their role, but it's not the thing that they're necessarily good at. So it is an interesting tool. This particular book, Kiersey Bates, is Myers-Briggs. So if you, it's the Myers-Briggs test, and all of this has come from the Jung. So if you look at Carl Jung and his all of his theories on personality type and so forth, that's where it all comes from. So it came from Jung to Myers-Briggs and Kiersey, and there's two or three others. But the test is generally known as the Myers-Briggs test, although Kiersey and Bates tried to carve their own little niche out and, you know, rebrand it the same thing. Is this all making sense to everybody? So let's move off of this. And Bob, you got those packets now? Okay. But let's go into some basic principles here, and I want to explicitly, although most of you know it already, share some of my biases. Oh, good, we got duct tape or masking tape. I don't think we need this, but let's keep this up where it's visible. You know, let's talk about some biases from all the conversations. I just want to kind of share with you, and a lot of you guys know this, but where I lean towards whenever possible. My first bias is always towards maximizing the quality for the student and the amount of revenue and value that you're gonna receive from a student. And if I look at my history and background, it's really all been in multiple school operations personally. You know, first as a part of the Junior Institute, which was 9, then 12, then 14 locations at the time in Washington, D.C., and then in my own situation, I actually had one location for a total of 3 months. So I opened my first school in August, my second school in December, opened 5 schools in the first 18 months, never had a single school really, because I was negotiating and prepping for the second school while opening the first school. So I went to Denver almost 30 years ago now. These full packets? Good. So everybody take one. That should be everybody in the room. What that bias leads to from a multi-school operation standpoint is a couple of things. One is, and one of the things with Mike Mertens and their operation is it's more difficult to end up with very tight retention numbers in a multi-school operation than in a single school. So as you end up with it staff operated rather than owner operated, it's not undoable, but it's more difficult to end up with that high level of personal service, high level of rapport, because getting employees to act like owners is difficult, right? And so one of the things that's impressive about their operation is the fact that they have really good retention. I mean, the dropout numbers are low, and I will say across multiple school operations, that's the exception, not the rule. If you talk to Bill Clark, he'll tell you that everybody's going to drop out 7% a month, doesn't matter what. Well, I think he's wrong. But what his bias is across the ATA organization, which is a big number of schools, and across his own organization, 7 to 9% has been the norm. So he assumes that that's a given. I've seen schools with 1% a month dropout rate. So if you look at Buzz Durkin and Keith Hafner are two of the best I've ever seen. Keith running a big single school operation, Buzz running a big single school operation. You know, but Buzz, in round numbers, grossing $70,000 a month, $60,000, $70,000 a month, enrolling maybe 6 students a month. If you extrapolate the numbers, running a little under 400 active students, adding 6 people a month. Right, so what's 6 as a percentage of 400 quickly? 1.5%, that means he's dropping out 1.5% a month, right? So the next thing is, if I had my druthers at all times, I would rather spend money on marketing than labor on marketing. And so if you come from what my bias is if I have a choice of let's go produce an infomercial and spend $250,000 this year on the infomercial versus let me motivate 60 people to be out giving out guest passes every day and in elementary schools and all that stuff, hell, I'll spend $250,000 in a heartbeat, because it's going to take me more than $250,000 of pain and aggravation to get the 60 guys to go do all the stuff I need them to do, right? So if you, and where and I'm telling you this because I think that for many of you, your marketing low-hanging fruit is to, especially as you get into the $1 million a year numbers. And my other bias is, frankly, I mean, in 85, I was running $1 million a year operation. So, I have a hard time identifying with, I've been in the business for 22 years and I'm up to $15,000 a month gross. I mean, it just doesn't compute in my mind. But part of why we attract people at the higher level is I irritate the guys who have been in business for 15 years and are up to 12,000 or something like that. What?
In Vancouver?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, they certainly annoy me.
Stress the hell out of me.
Yeah. But that being a bias is where it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, where it seems to me the biggest growth need that everybody in the room has, whether you're at the high end of the spectrum, meaning, you know, like Mike over here is in a supervisory role with 60 people, or in the lower end where you're now getting a couple good full-time staff, is the difference really is in creating marketing systems that work without you having to work. Okay, and so, you know, it's one thing. And June Reed, by the way, was always very diligent and very industrious. I mean, he was out personally running around supervising demos. We used to do stuff at Quantico and high schools and colleges and all over the place. But, you know, where they really took off is when they got 30-second spots to work on the Kung Fu TV show, and when they got the newspaper ads in the Washington Post to work, and when they got where it was high budget. So they weren't relying on all the kickboxers to feed traffic to them, right? So, but the things that I think is developmental needs for most everybody in the room is number one is moving your marketing to the point of being automatic and self-sustaining. So, where you can trade dollars for hours, or where you can have it so systematized that you don't have to be recreating the wheel on a monthly or quarterly basis. So I think for everybody in the room, but certainly as you end up where Eric Sabarge is at, you end up where Robert, where you're going to be pretty quickly, in a different microcosm. I mean, Sean, where you're already at because of the constraints of what the market is, right? And certainly in Buffalo, New York, with the kind of volume you guys already have, you should be in a situation where you can be so dominant in the market that people are seeing you everywhere, and where you're doing a good job with media educating people, and where you don't have to be out running around trying to do all this stuff personally. The next thing is in people management. And There's at least a couple components of this thing. There's the ongoing training and the ongoing supervision of what's happening on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. And then the next level is in building the culture. And an awful lot of why, you know, recently Apple has been in the news a lot, but, you know, Jobs, several people have quoted him, including Cook, is saying that his biggest brilliance was in building Apple, not particularly in creating any particular product. And that if you guys got that article I sent about the behind the scenes, and it was, remember the scene of Jobs, you know, kicking everybody's butt from the Mobile Me thing. But the story that he told in that book about the difference between the janitor and the CEO, remember what I'm talking about there, is they talked about it with every new VP. He would sit down and he would explain to him that somewhere on the continuum between janitor and CEO, you know, excuses and reasons don't count anymore. And see, if the janitor comes in 3 days in a row and doesn't empty the trash can in my office, we ask him why, and he says, well, the key got changed, nobody gave me the key, that's okay, he's not going to get fired. But he says the matrix changes at VP. At VP, nobody cares about reasons anymore, right? Is if you read the book West Point Way of Leadership, they talk about the first thing they teach a cadet is that there's only four possible answers to any question. Yes, sir, no, sir, no excuses, sir, I don't understand, sir, right? And the example they use in the book is two cadets are running out across the field to inspection, and that guy splashes mud on my shoes. Well, it's not permissible to say the reason that I failed inspection is he splashed mud on me, right?
Well, and when the senior cadet asks him, why are your shoes dirty?
Right.
No excuses, sir.
That's all that's left, you know. It's either I didn't understand it was supposed to be clean, or there's no excuses today.
I think that why question is powerful.
Mm-hmm. You know? And The biggest thing that I see in creating a bigger organization that then fails is a failure of that kind of culture among the people. It might be a good time for a restroom break since it seems like we hit.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, why don't we take a 5-minute restroom break? Okay. We may have hit the bladder level of several people. So, hey, that was always my thing. You know, in Kennedy's meetings, he'll go for like 8 hours without ever taking a break to pee.
And then bitch at you when you get out.
Exactly.
Say, as soon as you walk out the room, you know we're going to say the one thing.
Yeah.
That would. Yeah. He's probably right.